This is FNX.
Listen to Shoot the Defense. It's unbelievable, Jeff.
Hello, welcome to a very special edition of Shoot the Defense. I'm your host, Del, and joining me on this show is none other than former Real Monarchs head coach, Mark Briggs. Mark, welcome to the show, mate. How you doing?
Not too bad, mate. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure. How's the weather out there? What's it like?
Actually, it's decent. It's, you know, it's like it's in the 90s at the moment, so it's not too bad.
Oh, blimey. I feel like I'm talking to Mark Meredith. Every time I talk to him on the show, he's always like, yeah, I'm in my back garden, I've got the pool, you know, it's nice and sunny. And we're sitting here, you know, it's quarter to midnight, it's raining, wonderful. London weather,
lovely,
right?
Lovely.
How attractive.
There you go, mate.
Makes you not want to come back home, doesn't it?
Hey, there's something about home, though.
Yeah, true, that's a point. Well, look, speaking of home, you were actually at West Brom's Youth Academy in the late 90s. Now, I'm sure you've heard stories about the older generation and the jobs they did in and around the club as part of YTS scheme. I know Mark Waters came on quite recently and he was telling about, you know, cleaning boots and that kind of stuff. Were you cleaning toilets and boots, or was it totally different in the late 90s?
Yeah, no, we actually, my year was the first year that Adidas came in and did the three-year scholarship. So we were the first year they came in and started the 3 year scholarship, but it was kind of that transition year. So no, we were still doing, you know, cleaning the boots, making sure the boot room was all sorted out, making sure the locker rooms, the toilets, even the stadium at times. Yeah, we'd be waiting around until sometimes 6 or 7 o'clock at night for the coach to walk around and check all the, you know, check everything and make sure it was spotless so we could leave.
That's brilliant. Does that happen in the States then? What do they do with the youngsters out there?
That's certainly not that, mate. certainly not that. To a certain degree, I think some of it should be brought back, if I'm being honest. Mm. You know, it gives some accountability and shows people that they have to earn what they get in life and so forth. But no, it's not done out here. It's a completely different setup. Although the MLS teams now are, you know, they're all getting their own academies and doing things correct. It's a different setup. As youth soccer out here is a massive business. It's all pay to play.
Excellent. So while you're at West Brom, which first team players at the club gave the younger players advice?
Quite a few, actually. I was lucky because Danny Dicchio used to speak to me on a regular basis. Wow. Neil Clement, Derek McInnes, and Rule Fox.
Oh, wow.
So I was kind of lucky to have like some players that had been at the top and had experienced good things, passing on advice and telling me what was right and telling me what was wrong and trying to learn from them, in all honesty.
You know, when you mentioned, forgot his name, Rule Fox. I should really forget that name, because Rule Fox, I remember at Newcastle and Spurs and at Norwich City, he had bags of pace. Was he as quick on the training field as he was on the pitch?
It's funny because everyone, he came to West Brom and I think he was 32 or 33 at the time. You know, he was winding down, as they say. And I, you know, everyone used to talk about how quick he was and this, that and the other. But the biggest thing I remember about Foxy was his feet. His feet were, he had such quick feet and his first touch was, and you're just like, that's why he played at the top. You know, he was. He did have the blistering pace still, and he was still quick over 5 or 10 yards. But his feet, he could get out of tight situations, and it was just something that you came to expect of him.
Mm. And Danny Dicchio played a couple of seasons at Toronto. I think he's still there as part of the academy. Is that right?
Yeah, Dij. I think he's got the U18s now, or the U16s. He's a bit of a legend up there. Mm. So he settled. He's settled in up Toronto and does well for himself up there.
Absolutely. Well, interestingly enough, you actually had a stint in Denmark. Can you tell us about the mentality towards younger players out there from a coaching perspective and how it differs to England?
Yeah, I did. I did at the time. I left West Brom and went over to one of the directors at West Brom. Had just bought a club out in Denmark, Herfolga Bold Club. That it was called just outside of Copenhagen, and yeah, it was great to go out there and, you know, be a part of first team football and live away from home. But it was very difficult. Luckily, people all spoke English, so it was a little bit easier to get on and things like that. But as a young lad, you know, and you're in the locker room, the changing rooms, and you're hearing the coach and the players talk Danish, and then you hear like Briggs come up or whatever, and you start to get, well, what they're talking about, those types of things, you know. And as a young guy, you struggle to handle that. But in regards to how we were treated, you know, they put me in a good, lovely house. They looked after me, got me a car. I was looked after extremely well. And then the club actually was all about pushing through youngsters into their first team and giving younger players a chance, which I found was a lot different at the time to back home in England.
Yeah, because, I mean, I've spoken to a few people that you know, I've coached throughout Europe and whatnot, and especially the Dutch teams. They encourage the youngsters to ask questions, and they encourage the players to challenge coaches on certain decisions, which is part of their education, also part of learning discipline and learning respect, so to speak.
Yeah,
was that kind of encouraged out there?
It was, actually. I remember my first training session. He was only 16, and he was joining in the training. And he asked the coach a question. And at that point, I'd just come from, you know, I'd just come from a Gary Megson regime.
Oh, blimey.
Where
less said about that, the better, I think.
Yeah, I think we'll leave it at that. Where nobody asked a question and nobody got to interact with him, do you know what I mean? And this 16-year-old kid said to the coach, well, I don't understand, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to step or do you want me to or drop? And I was like, oh, this kid's got some confidence to be able to do that. But it turned out the more and more kids that came up, that was just how they were taught. That was just the way it is. And they were asking questions all the time. And I think it was helpful in them understanding and making sure they were doing exactly what the coach expected.
That's good. It's something that we don't really see too often in the UK. Something I forgot to ask you regarding West Brom. Did you ever get the chance to see Richard Schnickers and Enzo Maresca in action?
Yeah. I was really fortunate because when I was coming through, I had two great coaches in Richard O'Kelly and John Truick, who really pushed us. And Richard Schnickers had come down and, you know, he'd speak to us and work with us occasionally. And then I was fortunate enough to train with the first team a few times when I was only a youngster. So I got to train with Sneaks and got to know him quite well. And obviously he was a great player and a legend at West Brom. And then we signed Enzo whilst I had just broken into the first team squad. And there was Enzo, Adam Oliver, and myself as like the three young midfield players coming through. And Enzo was obviously went on to have a decent career, and he scored some great goals at West Brom. But I just remember him coming over, and every day after training, I think the club had just signed him for $5 million, I think it was.
Okay.
And every day after training, he'd be there after training, taking free kicks every single day, right foot, left foot, and just constantly, just practicing all the time, which was interesting to see, 'cause at that point, you know, young English players, it was kind of a, we're done, let's go home.
Yeah.
And this kid was the same age, and he was out on the field, like, practicing and making sure he gave himself the best opportunity to be successful, which ultimately he did.
Yeah, cracking player he was. I had to bring him up. He was a fantastic footballer.
Yeah, he was, mate. Mm-hmm. Both feet, read the game, got forward, scored great goals.
Absolutely. Right, I'm sure you'll agree that the most enjoyable and exciting stage of your playing career came when you moved to the States. How did this come about?
To be honest, I just kind of flitted around, went from West Brom to Denmark, did okay, then flitted around, but had trials here, there and everywhere. And then a friend of mine just said to me, do you fancy coming out and do basically PDL season? I went out and played in something that was called the Premier Development League. He said, just get your name about. So I just went out there and played for a few months up in Michigan and scored quite a few goals and did well. And I was a defensive midfield player. Just for me, scoring goals kind of told you what the level was.
Oh, blimey.
But no, it worked out well, and I ended up the following year signing down in Wilmington in the USL for David Irving, and ended up staying there, to be honest, stayed there until I came here to Utah and went and did pretty much every single role you could at the football club, player, assistant coach, head coach, and prior to that, you know, ran the youth club and put things in place for them to be successful as a youth club, you know, putting the building blocks in place, having a young academy and then different levels and different stages. So, no, it was a really enjoyable time in North Carolina.
I'll tell you what, it's interesting how many different leagues there are in the United States. I mean, look, I'm not clued up with the way it works out there, but you've got MLS, you've got USL, you've got this PDO league, that was called PDL, and then you had the NASL, which has that disbanded? I don't know if that's still going on.
The NASL unfortunately disbanded last year.
Mm.
So it happens quite a lot with that. So now the landscape is MLS, USL, and they've just introduced now USL Division 3.
Because they didn't have a third division, did they? Because effectively the PDL was like their fourth division. There was a vacant third
division. Yeah, yeah.
It's almost as if League One doesn't exist.
Exactly. That's it, mate. So now they've just brought that in, and that's going to act as kind of like the Division Three. And I think what USL are hoping is to, you know, to get the promotion relegation going within the USL. To add a little bit more to it.
They need that, as far as I'm concerned, because MLS doesn't have it. And if you look at, you know, historically, I think Chicago Fire would have been relegated 2 years on the bounce, because I think they're the worst team in the league. So they'd have been playing USL, and you'd have seen the likes of, I don't know, San Antonio, even, you know, your boys, or your old boys, should I say, playing.
Yeah.
But we'll go into them in just a moment. The powers that be pretty much hit this reset button on US soccer back when you first moved out there. Was it a bit difficult settling in?
It was certainly interesting. Just how things were done and just to see how far the game's gone in the years that I've been out here. It was different, let's say, when I first got out here. Whereas now it's completely full circle. And that, you know, they're teaching the right things to the younger players. The younger players are understanding tactics and understanding the game. And the game's even on the TV all the time, which is a huge learning tool for the youngsters now. So it's completely gone full circle right now. And I think they're heading in the right direction right now.
Mm, absolutely. And I know your playing career ended at the Wilmington Hammerheads, but while one door closes, another opens, and a new journey into coaching began at that very same club. Now, at what stage of your playing career did you decide coaching was going to be your next path?
To be honest, I did. I hadn't really thought about it. You know, as a player, you kind of just keep grinding it out and keep going. And then all of a sudden, the coach said to me, like, "Look, I want you to help me a little bit more on the playing side." I guess my legs must have gone, but it worked out quite well, and he started giving me, you know, a bit more control running training sessions and speaking to the group and things like that. So I appreciate. I did, at the time I was questioning it, but looking back now, I appreciate what Dave Irving did for me and the opportunity he gave me to step into coaching.
Mm. So which badges and qualifications have you gained?
So I've got the A license, the USSF A license. So that's like the top one in America. Although they've just bought in the pro license now. That'll be the next one I'm going for next year. So yeah, they've brought in some European guys from UEFA who have now basically moulded the US coaching badges the exact same as the UEFA ones. So, it's like, they have a lot more merit now to what they used to do.
So is that like, what do they call it, a pro pathway? So you've got A senior and then A youth. So you've got one for senior and one for youth. So it's two separate qualifications.
Yeah, so they've got the A senior and the A youth, as you said. And obviously, if you're in an academy system and that type of thing, you have to have the A youth. And then if you obviously want to be in the pro game, you have to have the A pro.
Right, so it just seems that you need a qualification for each league. Because I know that there's a grassroots one. I think there's a national B, C and D. So it's confusing for someone that doesn't really understand. But if you want to, I don't know, equate it to what we have out here, is it like a UEFA A license? Is it like anything like
that? Yeah. It's the equivalent to the UEFA A, let's say. It's the exact same as that.
Right.
And then obviously our B is supposedly the equivalent to UEFA B. Sorry. Right. And then I think it's the level 2 and level 1 below that, which would be over here at our C and D license.
Okay. So, just out of curiosity, do the European nations see that qualification as equal to the UEFA one? And the reason why I ask is that, you probably know this, you've got people that get their driving licenses from all over Europe and then they come to the UK and they can still use it because it's an EU license. But obviously, they're taught differently in different countries. Is that a similar sort of thing?
It's funny because I think the Federation right now are in talks with UEFA.
Okay.
Because the guy who's now the head of the US soccer coaching system, he worked for UEFA for 15, 20 years, I think. And he was behind the development of the UEFA coaching badges. So he's kind of brought that over to America. And then now supposedly the equivalent to what they do in Europe. So that's what I'm told.
Okay.
Hopefully that is the case.
Excellent. Now, you know as well as I do that there are hundreds of British coaches plying their trade abroad because of the lack of opportunities out here. Now, what are your opinions on this? Is there an old boys club in the UK, as some suspect?
It certainly comes across as that way. I think it's extremely difficult for young English coaches to get an opportunity, especially at the higher levels of the game. It seems to be opportunities are coming in the lower levels, which is great for development of our own coaches, our own game.
It's beggar's belief because, you know, when you see the likes of David Moyes, whose only achievements as a manager are winning the Division 2 title with Preston and the Community Shield with United, these guys are constantly getting jobs at big clubs. I mean, what message does this send to promising coaches? It must be extremely frustrating.
For sure, no, it's demoralising because, you know, like you say, it's almost like the merry-go-round and the same people jump on and carry on, come off, and then they get back on again. And there's younger coaches out there who, you know, have different philosophies and different styles and different man management and have kind of learned to grow with the way the game is now. So it's difficult for younger coaches, and you do see a lot of good English coaches going abroad and plying their trade and trying to make a name for themselves elsewhere.
You know, I look at someone like Dean Saunders, for example, who, let's be honest, he's had a bit of a crap managerial career, you know, as a Wrexham, Doncaster, Wolves, Crawley Town, and then Chesterfield. And I know, having spoken to someone that supports Chesterfield, Dean Saunders basically got the job because his agent knew the chairman. Now, you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And it's absolutely ridiculous because people such as yourself, people such as, you know, Mark Meredith, who we spoke about before the show, Jason With, you know, Peter With's son has gone to the Far East to coach out there. Numerous coaches with so much talent and ability have had to go abroad because out here they don't want to know, they don't want to entertain them because they would rather take a risk, I wouldn't say calculate risk, a risk on managers like, I don't know, Frank Lampard, who hasn't really done anything in the coaching world. Let's be honest. You know, whereas people such as yourself that's got years of experience get overshadowed because you're not a huge name, no disrespect. So,
yeah, of course. And
then there's other things that I'd like to discuss with you, and something that Marcus Rashford said to The Independent about black coaches in the game. I know you said it helps when you see black coaches in the game. You need that as something to look forward to. It's something I believe will change, that there are more black coaches, and I hope it does. I'd never turn down the opportunity to be a coach or help a team. I think it will go up a notch. Now, this is what Rashford has said. What can you tell us about the number of black football coaches in America? Are they overlooked as much as they are in the UK?
I wouldn't say overlooked, although there's not many, black coaches in the game. But they're coming into it, and I think people have to give opportunities to coaches based on their talent, not on the colour of their skin. And that's something that I think a culture that will slowly evolve and slowly change, and you will be looked at for what you bring to the table as a coach rather than the colour of your skin when you walk into a room.
The thing is, why do you think there aren't that many black coaches in America? Do you think it's because football is still evolving out there and there isn't as much interest as we'd like there to be?
I genuinely do, yeah. I think as the game evolves, there'll be a lot more interest and a lot more understanding of the actual game and what goes into the game. I think there'll be a lot more coaches, and there are a lot of coaches now, but I think it's only going to get bigger and better, and there's only going to be more opportunities for those coaches.
Absolutely. Let's talk about West Brom again, because I know they're currently fourth in the table, 4 points off top spot, and they're the only team out of the three that were relegated to have kept their manager. What do you make of Darren Moore? He's impressed a lot of people so far, hasn't he?
Yeah, Moore's a good guy. I'm actually good friends with him, so I guess I'm a little bit biased. But no,
you're sounding like Rodri. You sound like Rodri because they were together at Torquay as well. So he's we're team Darren Moore in this place.
No, Moore. I hope Moore continues with the success he's had so far. I think it's refreshing to see someone who's genuine with what he says and genuine with what he wants to do, and kind of wears his heart on his sleeve, you know. And then for him to be a black coach in this second tier in English football is also, you know, something, an achievement in itself in today's age.
I think it helps that he's a bit of a club legend as well, doesn't it? I mean, you see managers like Zidane go to Real Madrid. I know Real Madrid are probably a bad example because they're the best team in the world and they had Cristiano Ronaldo and they won three Champions Leagues, I know. But let's be honest, they've had other managers and they've down tools for them, whereas Zidane come in and they won three on the bounce. So I think it's got a lot to do with not just him being a very good coach, because he obviously is, because he's doing a remarkable job. But, excuse me, I think because he's a club legend, you know, the club is in his DNA.
Yeah, definitely. I think people can relate to him, you know, the players can relate to him. He's been in that position. He's been in a lot of scenarios that they're about to be in or have an experience, you know. So I think it's important that he can put himself in their shoes. I think that's one angle that players will look at it. And I think also he can relate to the fans. Mm. He's a local lad. He knows the ins and outs of the club. He knows the ins and outs of the city. He knows what it takes to be successful within that demographic of West Bromwich.
And he must know about the youth academy as well, because he's been working in and around the club for a while.
Exactly. He's come through. He's been involved in the academy system. He knows the younger players that are coming through. He knows the attitude of the club, the beliefs of the club, and I think he carries that into the first team, which is great for the younger players and the younger coaches to see that somebody's gone through the system and is now in charge of the first team.
I think it's quite impressive that, you know, Mark Harrison, the academy manager, has kind of implemented this West Brom TID, as they call it. There's been so many players that have come through in terms of homegrown talent, like Berahino, who he hasn't done great at Stoke. I think he got his first goal in like 2 years the other day. But, you know, many decent footballers have come through the ranks at West Brom. And, you know, we talk about Aston Villa being a big team in the Midlands, but West Brom, in terms of an academy perspective, they're just as big.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think they're one of the best academies in the country now, right now. You know, they're constantly, like you say, you reeled off a few names there, but they're constantly developing young players on a regular basis that go on. If they don't go on and play in West Brom's first team, they go on and play in a first team somewhere, which is, you know, it only shows the good work and the good coaches and the good system that they have in place at the club.
Absolutely. Right, talk about youth development. I understand you had a hand in restructuring the whole youth system at the Wilmington Hammerheads. What would you say was the main objective for this?
Well, you know, it was a small town, and I just saw an opportunity to bring the soccer community, as they say over here, the football community, together. There was a number of youth clubs within the town, and like I said, it's a big money business, youth football in America. You know, I think kids pay. It's like $1,500 per season to play. So I just saw an opportunity to have the youth club and then the first team on top, because the first team wasn't involved with the youth club in the town. It was just two separate entities. So we managed to bring it together. So then you can have, like we just spoke about with West Brom, you can implement a system. You can implement development, and you can give, you know, you can dangle that carrot for younger players to one day want to play in the first team. And we managed to bring it all together, and that was how it all started.
And how do you think they're doing now? Have you heard anything about them, or do you know much about how they've progressed since?
Yeah, I'm still, it's good actually. I still keep in touch with a lot of the younger coaches there, a lot of people there. Got a lot of good friends, and you know, a lot of the teams now are playing in better divisions and the academy system, and for the girls game they're playing the ECNL now, which is level for the academy system. So I guess it's all coming to a head now, and the players have developed at the rate that we was hoping they would.
Excellent. Now, I didn't realise it until you told me earlier that you worked alongside the late Liam Miller. I haven't heard a bad word said about him, mate. What was he like?
Just an unbelievable person. Completely genuine. Just loved the game. Loved the game, loved his family. Just a quiet guy with bags and bags of knowledge.
Did he ever talk about United? Because, you know, I remember when he signed for the club and people were comparing him to Roy Keane, and they're two completely different players. It's just only because, yeah, you know, he's a Celtic boy kind of thing. Did he ever talk about his time at the club?
Yeah, it was. You had to force it out of him.
Oh wow!
You know, he wasn't one of those that would talk freely about. You know, he didn't gloat about anything. He just got on with his everyday life. And but I signed a player when he signed for me as a player for Wilmington. I had a young midfield player named Zev Tobley, his name was, and obviously playing next to Liam, he saw we'd signed Liam and he was like super excited. So on every trip he would make sure he sat next to Liam, and you could see Liam, and he didn't want to like tell him to do one, do you know what I mean? Uh-huh. And Zev would ask him all sorts of questions. So yeah, that was how we got to hear some of the stories from United, and some of the things, you know, he'd talk about. And a lot of times he'd talk about Sir Alex Ferguson and just what he was like and how he managed people and how he spoke to people. And I kind of took a lot of that from Liam. And then obviously when we were one-on-one and as he became my assistant and things like that, we grew a lot closer, and he used to tell me a lot of stuff about United in that regard, and obviously he held it in high regard. And I was fortunate to get the time with him that I did and spend the time with him that I did.
Yeah, it was this massive loss. I was absolutely shocked when I found out he was ill for a start. Because I actually connected with him on LinkedIn, you know, and you know, he seemed like a nice lad, and you know, as I told you before, the people that I've spoken to about him haven't got a bad word to say about him. He was just a cool guy, you know.
Yeah, it was a hard one. We were we'd been in the office every day, and he'd been going to see the physio and the doctor, and you know, saying his stomach didn't feel right. And every now and then, me and him used to take it in turn, joining in training if we needed an extra body or whatever. And a couple of times he would join in, and he'd say, like, "Briggsy, I'm just struggling. Like, I feel like I'm unfit." And like, he still looked after himself, like, to this day. Didn't drink alcohol, you know, ate well, didn't smoke. Like, he was the ultimate professional, even now as a coach. And when we were coaching, so it came as a surprise. And then we had an away trip where we played Sacramento, and then we played Reno. And I remember turning round in the Reno game and looking at him, and I asked him something, and he said to me, he was just pale, and he said to me, I can't get up, off the bench. And he was in agony. And then when we got back to Utah, he went to the hospital, and that was when we found out that he got stage 4 cancer.
Bloody hell. Poor lad and poor family. That's horrible, horrible.
It wasn't for Claire and the kids. It's obviously been an extremely, extremely difficult time. You know, and hopefully I still speak to Claire, and hopefully they're doing okay and they're being looked after back in Ireland.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. Let's talk about youth development again, mate. Which nation do you think takes youth development more serious, the UK or the States?
I think they both take it serious. I think England obviously have changed the system, and it seems to be the fruits of the labour seem to be coming to fruition now, you know, with the success that they've had at the younger ages. But in fairness to America, at the younger ages, that, you know, they're a very good side. They do things right. They just don't seem to get it right on the at the full national team right now. But no, I think England are obviously a step ahead, you'd say, especially now with how Gareth Southgate's completely changed things and doing the right things from the bottom up, really.
Absolutely. Right, tell me, how did you get the Real Monarchs hot seat? And looking back on your time there, how would you evaluate your performance?
We actually, with Wilmington actually, and Liam, we got to the quarterfinals of the Open Cup, which is like the FA Cup back home. And we withdrew against Real Salt Lake out here in Utah. And I guess you would say we were pretty ballsy with our approach. And we sat down and we spoke about how we were gonna approach the game. And I just figured, you know, we're gonna go at them. We're gonna play. And I had some good players. I had Liam Miller. I had a Brazilian centre back, Bruno Peroni, who's now playing in La Liga. I had Christian Basagar, the left winger, got sold in the African Nations Cup. I think it's in China now. He got sold for $15 million. So I had some players that I knew could, you know, that I thought they could hang with the MLS players. Mm. And so we basically just, you know, we just went at them and pressed them from the beginning and got in their face a little bit. And we moved the ball and kept the ball well, and we managed to go 2-0 up. And we were 2-0 up until the 78th minute, and then they brought on João Plata and Yura Movician. And Plata rocketed one in the top corner with his first touch. And you're just like, oh, okay, here we go. But we managed to hang on. And then in the 86th minute, we had one of my players had a one-on-one. Unfortunately, he didn't. He missed it, and the keeper saved it. And they went up the other end and equalised. And they took us to, we went to penalties. and we lost on penalties. But after that game, Real Salt Lake's general manager, Craig Wybill, came downstairs and, you know, basically approached me and came up to me and said he was very impressed with how I coached the game. He was very impressed with how I managed myself on the sidelines. And he wanted to, you know, would I be interested in talking a little bit further with him? And that's how it went from that conversation with Craig to at the end of the season, Wilmington folded.
Oh, wow.
Due to financial reasons. And Real Salt Lake approached me to come in. And that was how I ended up at Real Salt Lake. Initially, I was due to come as an assistant coach. But certain things happened. The first team head coach got fired. The coach who was due to come in here, Mike Pecky, got moved up to the first team. And then I got moved up to head coach of the Monarchs.
Wow. And were you on the bench or were you involved when Salt Lake lost to United in the friendly game last summer?
Yeah, I was on the bench. I was involved in the game. A lot of my players from the Monarchs got minutes, and obviously Jose Mourinho took time out to, you know, to talk to us, and he spoke to me specifically, which I was kind of, you know, extremely grateful. He came on the field. He came up to me, and there's an article and Sky put out back home in England, just about, I guess, the season we'd had so far, and that we were playing against Manchester United and Mourinho. And he just came up to me and, you know, said he saw the article. It was a good article, and to keep up the good work. And he spoke to me. You know, he spoke to me after that, which for me was. Which for me, you know, was a huge thing to have someone like that come up to me and take time out to speak to me. You know, he didn't have to do that, so I hold him in the highest regard.
There you go. See, listeners, Jose isn't a bad man. Leave him alone. He gets a lot of stick in the UK, man. You can tell.
Yeah, no, he does. I keep up with it, but I'm sure he's used to it. You know, that's part of being at that level.
Of course. Now, Mark, I'm going to make this a bit of a serious subject now. Sorry to do this, but, you know, I Googled your name, and the second article that came up was ESPN's report in May, which had the headline, Real Monarchs manager Mark Briggs charged with domestic assault. Now, the charges have since been dropped on the basis that, as your attorney said at the time, there was no merit and the case shouldn't have been filed. Now, there's no need to discuss the full story because it's just that. It's a story. There's no truth to it. Unfortunately, we've seen accusations destroy people's careers. And even if a person is found innocent, there's always someone saying, there's no smoke without fire. So, can you tell us what these false claims have done to your career and how they've affected you, if they have, not just your reputation, but also from, I don't know, like a mental state?
Yeah, no, it's affected me immeasurably, to be honest, in ways I can't truly explain. And the ripple effect is larger than I guess anyone can ever imagine until you're put in that position. Just little things like, you know, not wanting to leave the house, not being comfortable talking to people. It has an effect that I don't think people realise.
Did you receive any comments on social media from certain people that like to troll others?
To be honest, you kind of cut yourself off from it. How I found out was a little different. I actually found out that these charges were being put against me in the press, like everybody else. So it was a little, you know, it was a little difficult, kind of a whirlwind that happened just overnight. I'm just glad that the truth has prevailed. And it was nice because anybody that knows me, anybody that's spent time with me, anybody that's spoken to me knows that that's just not in my character. It's just something that, you know, I wouldn't do. I was raised by a single mother. I have two sisters. And it's just not me. I guess the hardest thing throughout all of it has been nobody's truly thought about my daughter.
Mm.
And at no point has anyone stopped to think how this would all affect her. And, you know, I don't want to speak too much about that, because my main priority is shielding my daughter from that.
And you've probably thought about it millions of times in your head anyway, so, you know, saying it out loud isn't going to make much of a difference, is it, to be fair?
No, it's not. It's nice to see, you know, that people saw sense and the truth prevailed. But people are in the public eye, like myself and many other people in the public eye, who have had these things filed against them or things come out and said this, that and the other. And I think, you know, if people have made a mistake, then the punishment should be sufficed. But just because you're in the public eye shouldn't be able to, you know, somebody's life, somebody's hard work shouldn't be destroyed based on something somebody said when nobody's done any homework on the person that's come out and said these allegations.
Yeah. The annoying thing about this is that the only person that suffers most is the person that's been accused of it, and the person that's accusing the person just gets away with it, you know? It happens everywhere. You know, we've seen it happen so many times. Someone, let's say a footballer gets accused of rape, you know, and then he gets cleared. So what happens to the person making that accusation? They you know, they just walk and it's like, oh, well, I'm just the person that accused the player of raping me, but, you know, nothing happened, really.
But, yeah, it's a difficult one in general.
Yeah.
But that's one of the hardest things to look at, you know, especially when you know that you haven't done anything and there's all these horrible things being said about you all over the world. Mm. And, you know, certain people are able to just walk away scot-free.
Yeah.
You know, it's a difficult pill to swallow.
Of course, it's understandable. Now, the thing is, I can understand Real Salt Lake were worried about their image when this all began, but it seems to me they weren't supportive towards you at all. Is that right? Or were there people out there that were actually taking care of you in that sense?
There were people within the organisation who were and continue to be supportive. I guess we'll leave it at that.
Okay, that's fine. Tell me something, now your name is cleared, what's your next target?
You know, I just want to get back into coaching. I love what I do, and I'm hoping that people look at my body of work over the last three years as a head coach, you know, first with Wilmington, and then with Real Monarchs, obviously, last year, and then Real Monarchs again this year, and judge me and base their opinions on my ability as a coach and not on a fabricated story.
Absolutely. Well, Mark, one more thing before I let you go. Thank you ever so much for joining me. It's been great talking to you. It's almost been an hour. We've gone on for an hour talking about football. This is amazing.
There you go, mate. It must have been time flies when you're having fun.
Absolutely, mate. Absolutely. Would you like to tell our listeners your Twitter handle, just in case you jump on Twitter one day and you get a few alerts saying, I heard you on the Stell Show?
Yeah, my Twitter handle's MarkBriggs6.
Excellent. There you go. Superb. Oh, that was Mark Briggs, ladies and gentlemen. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to this gentleman. I really hope he gets another job in the game, because, as I said before, quality coaches are few and far between, especially coming from the UK and getting the opportunities abroad is very difficult, cracking the UK, which is bizarre, really. But yeah, give us a follow on Twitter at Shoot Defence. We have a Facebook group page. And that is pretty much it for this week. So if you enjoyed the show, again, leave a comment and we'll be back very soon. Take care.